Welcome to IRIS, listeners, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, September 7th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look at today's weather forecast. It comes to us from KCRG in Cedar Rapids, and it's titled, Another Nice One Today. A few pockets of fog may be found once again this morning, though this is expected to lift very early. Plan on a nice mix of sun and scattered clouds, with highs generally in the lower 80s. Tomorrow and Friday continue to look great, with highs well into the 80s on both days. Due to lower humidity, the heat index shouldn't be an issue. This weekend, we are watching a cold front approaching the area, which may bring some showers or possibly a storm late Saturday into Saturday night. These showers will probably linger into Sunday as well, sending highs down into the 60s by then. Let's list the stories on the front page now. $11.6 million bond on Hudson ballot. Church to be raised this month. And we will begin reading, Cedar Valley cancer toll exceeds the national average. Cancer takes a toll on Cedar Valley residents. Story filed by Donald Promnitz. And begins with a photograph of a couple sitting together in their living room. And the caption says, Calvin and Bonnie Wilson in their home in Waterloo. The Wilsons lost multiple loved ones to cancer over the years, thinning their large family. Dateline Waterloo. Calvin and Bonnie Wilson pride themselves on being part of a big family, but that family's numbers have dropped sharply in recent years. Calvin, 82, was one of 14 siblings, but now he has just three brothers and one sister. Two siblings died in infancy, while cancer claimed two brothers and two sisters within the course of a year. Bonnie, 72, lost her sister to cancer the day after Thanksgiving. It was especially hard in 2021, when they found themselves attending eight funerals. Quote, it's been nice to have a big family, said Calvin, who is more commonly known as Jim. But it's rough when they all go boom, 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 unquote. The Wilsons try to live their lives to the fullest to honor those no longer alive, but it isn't easy. Holidays and birthdays are reminders of everyone they've lost. Quote, it's very hard on Jim, Bonnie said. He sat in that chair a lot, just looking out a long time, watching the birds and thinking about what happened, and was trying to figure all out in his mind. Why? While family have died from various causes, from accidents to heart disease, cancer has been the main killer. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention lists cancer as the number two killer of Cedar Valley residents, claiming 10,383 lives between 1999 and 2020. At 214.4 deaths per 100,000 residents, the area is well above the national average of 187.4. Among the deadliest of these were lung cancer and blood cancers, for example, leukemia and lymphoma. Over 22 years, lung and other respiratory cancers claimed 2,830 lives, or 58.4 people per 100,000. According to Dr. Behil Rahim, an oncologist with Unity Point Health, the Cedar Valley's high cancer rates can be attributed in no small part to lifestyle. As with the Cedar Valley's high rates of heart disease, unhealthy diet, smoking, and alcohol abuse are gateways to various cancers. Quote, in terms of what are risk factors, for example, many of them overlap with many of the risk factors of heart disease, Rahim said. So we do end up seeing, I think, some overlap with heart disease specifically. Cancer has some overlap with the risk factors for that too, unquote. CDC data from 2019 show 16.4% of adult Iowans smoke, and smoking is the leading cause of lung cancer. Data from the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program, better known as WIC, shows 36.7% of the adult population in the state is obese. These are the risk factors Rahim identified as modifiable. But there are other risk factors that can't be modified. For example, Age is a big risk factor for a range of cancers, including colorectal, prostate, and breast cancer. However, advancements in both knowledge and technology have curbed death rates. Doctors are modifying their approach as new information emerges. Previously, it was standard to begin screening patients for colon cancer at age 50. But in recent years, Rahim said, the illness is being detected in younger patients. That has caused doctors to begin screening at age 45, increasing the odds it will be caught before becoming untreatable. Quote, I think that people are living longer. We're screening, having better screening tools available. Also, we're scanning people more often for other conditions that happen to, incidentally, find cancers a bit earlier. And so we do have a pretty high rate of cancer detected in general, unquote. When cancer is diagnosed, a family may have no other course but to brace for the worst. In the case of Stacy Winky, director of clinical services at Cedar Valley Hospice, it was her ex-husband, Mike Taylor. While no longer married, they remained on amicable terms and shared a mutual concern for their children, who had an especially hard time with it. According to Winky, Taylor seemed fine, even going to the first Field of Dreams game in 2021, with their oldest son months before diagnosis. But when doctors found cancer, it had already spread. He had only a few weeks to live. Quote, it was a very fast thing, and he got ill very quickly. And the kids really wanted him to do everything possible, Winky said. Quote, it was just too fast, unquote. He entered hospice with Winky's help. Her concerns were those not only of a caregiver, but of a mother. Her children suffered alongside their father in his final days. Quote, even after being hospice nurse for 25 years, it hits different when it hits home a little bit, Winky said. Quote, you try to think you're the most empathetic when it hits home, unquote. For the Wilsons, the specter of cancer is always on their minds. They don't smoke, they try to eat well, and make good decisions. COVID-19 has put a damper on some activities, like getting together with family once a month for dinner. Cancer has thinned the family's ranks, but they're still going strong. Quote, they're with us constantly in our minds, Bonnie said. Quote, and what is left of the Wilsons has formed a real bond because they worry about each other all the time now. They've lost so many in their family, unquote. Next, we have a story filed by Maria Cooper. $11.65 million bond issue on the ballot for Hudson Schools. And the article begins with a photograph of the exterior of Hudson High School. Dateline Hudson. Hudson Community School District property taxes would increase if voters approve a bond issue Tuesday to make facility improvements at the high school. Superintendent Tony Voss said the time is past due to make an update in the building. Quote, the HVAC system is in need of repair, Voss said. We've been limping this system along for many years, and that component alone is about $2.2 million to replace. And here we see a picture of a smiling Superintendent Voss. The proposed $11.65 million general obligation bond issue will pass if at least 60% of voters cast ballots in favor of it. If approved, the district would begin multiple projects at the high school. The tax impact of issuing the bonds would be $11.09 per month on a home with an assessed value of $100,000, or $133 per year. For agricultural property, the tax impact would be $29.91 per month on 100 acres of agricultural land, or $359 per year on that 100 acres of land. The money would be used to update building systems and infrastructure such as windows, plumbing, lighting, flooring, cabinetry, and HVAC systems, as well as converting underused space into classrooms, creating a safer main entrance, rebuilding the career and technical education labs, and adding gym space. A community-led facility task force identified the projects earlier this year. There were 646 respondents. A little more than half were parents of school-aged children. 89 were school employees. 41 were agricultural landowners, 17 were commercial property owners, 30 were business owners, and 22 owned additional property. Of the total, 56% of them supported the general obligation bond. Parents were more supportive at 71%. The main entrance and gym expansion were seen as lower priority on the list of projects. If additional funding becomes available, other projects would include adding classrooms at the high school, updating and expanding the auditorium, building a wrestling multipurpose space, and adding turf to the football field. School district officials said some people are speculating that these improvements are needed due to open enrollment. A flyer from Hudson Schools stated that since 2016, the district has seen a steady increase in enrollment. The district is projected to grow more in the next 5 years due to new housing developments. Quote, "The improvement projects would be necessary even if we had no open-enrolled students," Voss said in the flyer. "In some ways, a school is like an airplane. It doesn't matter if the plane is 100% full or half full. It still needs to be in a condition in which it can get from point A to point B," unquote. Two other issues will be voted on Tuesday, a physical plant and equipment levy and a revenue purpose statement. The PEPL is a voter-approved levy that generates funds a school district can use for infrastructure and equipment repairs, purchases, and improvements. If this is renewed, the levy would maintain a maximum property tax rate impact of $1.34 per $1,000 of taxable property value. The PEPL is not a new idea, rather a continuation of a current levy the district has had in place for decades. The third topic is a revenue purpose statement. Approving the statement would continue the district's investment of 1% sales tax funds in school infrastructure projects. The statewide tax is called Secure and Advanced Vision for Education. School districts are required to get voter approval of the statements, which lay out the purposes that the proceeds will be used for. From the survey issued to voters, 83% of respondents support the renewal of the sales tax revenue purpose statement and the PEPL. A simple majority of voters must favor these measures for them to pass. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Tuesday at the Hudson Community Center at 525 Jefferson Street in Hudson. Hudson Community School District residents who live in Waterloo can go online to find their polling location. Andy Malone filed our next story, Church to be Razed This Month. Developer for sure to demolish church this month, make way for pocket neighborhood. Dateline Cedar Falls. The plans remain the same for the property, housing the old church at the corner of 9th and Clay Streets, despite none having been formally submitted to the city. And the story begins with a photograph of the church with a refuse dumpster on the sidewalk in front of it. And the caption says, "Developer Brian Weingert purchased the church at 215 West 9th Street and plans to demolish the building to make way for a residential project." Developer Brian Weingert said Tuesday he anticipates within the next couple of weeks, and for sure by the end of September, tearing down the former Cedar Falls Mennonite Church at 215 West 9th Street. According to Julie Hoffman Klinkowitz, collections manager and curator of the Cedar Falls Historical Society, the building was constructed and dedicated in 1916 when it was the Evangelical United Brethren Church and replaced a brick building at the time used by the parish and constructed on the same land in 1876. Before then, the founders held services in private homes beginning in 1857 and originally built a simple frame church on the corner of Franklin and 9th Streets in 1860. Hoffman Klinkowitz's findings showed. Weingert confirmed that the city has received an application for a demolition permit or the plans for the proposed pocket neighborhood development, which would offer 12 smaller cottages. Weingert guesses he'll sell those homes for $350,000 in today's market. He closed on the sale of the 0.59 acres on June 23rd for $326,000 from developer Brent Dahlstrom, according to property records. Before Dahlstrom sold it, he said his intentions were to repurpose the church for a mixed use, possibly some combination of multifamily and office space. The city council's ongoing discussions about changes to the downtown zoning code made, quote, it difficult to see where things would end up, and was completely the reason why, Dahlstrom said, that he unloaded the property. It falls under the jurisdiction of the newly adopted Downtown Character District Zoning Code, which does not mandate site plans be formally reviewed by the Planning and Zoning Commission and the Council. And now we turn the page to the Cedar Valley section, and the lead story on this page is Merry Melodies. Phelps Youth Pavilion adds outdoor musical instrument park to site. Story filed by Melody Parker. Dateline Waterloo. There once was a mosaic dolphin structure displayed in front of the Waterloo Center for the Arts. Now it's a manta ray. The undulating multi-octave chime metallophone, constructed of pipe steel and aluminum, is one of six outdoor musical instruments in the new Phelps Melody Park. The park is located at the Waterloo Center of the Arts and Phelps Youth Pavilion. A grand opening celebration is planned for October 8th. A family program planned for 1 p.m. will include a ribbon cutting, a short musical performance demonstration, games and craft activities. Refreshments will be served. Those visiting the Youth Pavilion that day will receive one free admission with each regular admission. Quote, it's a really exciting way for us to connect with people in an unexpected setting. It gives the public a little taste, a sample of the fun and educational experiences in the Phelps Youth Pavilion. We wanted to move that sense of play found inside to be outside those doors, said Executive Director Kent Schenkel. These on-plane air instruments are a collection of chimes, metallophones, and drums that welcome musicians of all ages and abilities to discover the subtle shifts of tones and individual sound combinations. The sextet also includes swirl, a structural instrument with chimes ringing from soprano to alto, pagoda bells, a series of eight stainless steel bells arranged vertically with two mallets to allow people to play simultaneously, quote, tuned drums, a set of five resonated drums, contrabass chimes, seven aluminum chimes ranging in height from 7 to 9 feet tall, that are pitched one octave below middle C, and melody, a series of nine anodized aluminum keys or bars set in a frame that can be played with a pair of mallets. Quote, because so much of what we do is interactive, we wanted that to be incorporated in some way outside as well. We wanted that reflected in a front and center way, said Schenkel. Phelps Melody Park was initially inspired by the public's enjoyment of Mark's Park, a splash pad and play structure for kids 12 and under, located next to the River Loop Amphitheater. Quote, we witnessed the success and demand for Mark's Park and realized people are looking for free, fun, and educational things to do with their kids. That got us thinking about what we could do that ties into our mission and reflects experiences available in the pavilion, but in an outdoor setting, open 24/7, and without charge, Schenkel explained. Installation of the musical sculptures took place recently following reconstruction of the parking lot and hardscape surrounding the entrance to the art center and pavilion. Quote, the instruments are tuned to be played like any traditional musical instrument, so it's possible to have small group performances there, the director said. In addition, a pair of kaleidoscope sculptures were installed adjacent to the instrument park. These are interactive planters that echo the art and perception experiences found in the art center. Quote, we're now working toward adding some kinetic sculptures that move and engage people in different ways, Schenkel said. The dolphin, by the way, is now installed with other outdoor sculptures on the Riverwalk behind the Art Center. Funds for Phelps Melody Park were provided by Friends of the Art Center, Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa, a memorial contribution from the Dr. Michael Holen family, and support from the Iowa Arts Council and Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. Now the next story was filed by Jeff Reinitz. Couple arrested for $13,000 in drugs. Child endangerment among the charges Illinois residents face in the stop. Dateline Independence. Buchanan County Sheriff's deputies arrested an Illinois couple after finding more than $13,000 worth of drugs in their car as they were passing through Iowa over the weekend. Deputies stopped their Chevrolet Malibu for speeding around 3 a.m. Saturday in the 2300 block of Iowa Highway 150 south of town. There were two children in the vehicle, an infant and a three-year-old, and authorities noticed an odor of marijuana. A search turned up a backpack located in the back seat between the children that contained LSD, 46 ecstasy pills shaped like skulls, more than half a pound of marijuana, 18 grams of crack cocaine, 57 grams of psilocybin mushrooms, and 91 oxycodone pills, according to court records. Police also found two jars of THC wax, a loaded firearm, a digital scale, and $3,606 in cash. The deputies believed the drugs were purchased in Illinois and brought to Iowa to sell. Rogelio Perez Jr., 36, of Chicago Heights, was arrested for multiple counts of possession with intent to deliver, 5 counts of violation of the Drug Tax Stamp Act, 2 counts of child endangerment, and carrying weapons. The driver, Maria Morez Ruiz, 27, was charged with multiple counts of possession with intent to deliver, 5 counts of violation of the Drug Tax Stamp Act, and 2 counts of child endangerment. She was also ticketed for speeding. Our next story was filed by courier staff. AARP Fraud Watch comes to Waterloo. Dateline Waterloo. AARP Iowa, with the Attorney General's Office and the Iowa Insurance Division, will be in Waterloo as part of a 14-city statewide Fraud Watch education tour. The free Waterloo Fraud Watch dinner will take place from 5:30 to 7 o'clock p.m. Wednesday at the Waterloo Center for the Arts, 225 Commercial Street. The stop will feature an education program on the top 5 Iowa scams based on complaints submitted to the Iowa AG's Consumer Protection Division. Participants will also have an opportunity to ask questions or share scams they are seeing in their communities. It is open to the public, but advance registration is required online at the state's site. A full list of the tour dates and locations is also available online at the same site. All events include a light lunch or dinner. Quote, imposter scams are the number one scam affecting older Iowans, and our goal is to educate the public on how to avoid scams and fraud, said Brad Anderson, AARP Iowa State Director. We are proud to partner with the Iowa Attorney General's Office and Iowa Insurance Division to raise awareness of these popular scam tactics and make sure Iowans have the tools they need to protect themselves. Now here's an article that comes from the Associated Press. Report, East Mediterranean at risk as the world heats up. Nicosia, Cyprus. The Eastern Mediterranean and Middle East are warming almost twice as fast as a global average, with temperatures projected to rise up to 5 degrees Celsius, 9 degrees Fahrenheit, by the end of the century if no action is taken to reverse the trend, a new report says. The region will experience unprecedented heat waves, more severe and longer-lasting droughts and dust storms, and rainfall shortages that will compromise water and food security for the region's 400 million people, according to a summary of the report released Tuesday. the Eastern Mediterranean, and the Middle East are more susceptible to warming trends because of their unique natural characteristics, like large desert expanses and lower water levels, the study said. The report was prepared by an international group of scientists overseen by the Cyprus Institute's Climate and Atmosphere Research Center and the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry, originally published in June in the journal Reviews of Geophysics. It aims to underscore the impact of climate change in the region ahead of the United Nations Climate Summit in Egypt this November. Arid climate zones will expand northward, and snow-capped mountains in the more northern climes will diminish during this century, said Dr. George Zidis, who co-authored the report. Although the sea level in the region is projected to rise at a pace similar with other global estimates, many Mediterranean countries are unprepared to deal with it, he said. Quote, this would imply severe challenges for coastal infrastructure and agriculture and can lead to the salinization of coastal aquifers, warned Zidis. Saltier water from the rising sea levels and low rainfall can severely damage crops and fisheries. The region's most vulnerable groups, including the elderly, children, and pregnant people, will face a major health challenge, said Max Planck Institute Director Jos Lilleveld, who was part of the study. Many European nations already have initiatives to aid vulnerable people in extreme weather. The region is rapidly overtaking the European Union as a source of greenhouse gases and becoming a major emitter on a global scale, the paper suggests. China, the U.S., India, and the EU are currently the world's largest emitters. Several Mediterranean countries are also part of the European bloc. If the Paris Agreement target of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius is met, it would limit the temperature increase in the region to about 2 degrees Celsius, or 3.6 in Fahrenheit, the study said. The report urged the region to quickly reduce its reliance on greenhouse gas emissions, especially in the energy and transportation sectors. The study's projections for the region are in line with other scientific studies, including a major report published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change earlier this year. The UN's climate report termed the Mediterranean as a climate change hotspot, which is vulnerable to droughts, coastal erosion, and heat waves. And now, listeners, we would like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, September 7th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Waterloo. Mary Dean Downs, 78, of Waterloo, died on Sunday, September 4th, 2022, at Pinnacle Specialty Care in Cedar Falls. She was born on September 29th, 1943, in West Union, the daughter of Earl Dean and Viola Marie Joyce Scully Blake. She graduated from Waterloo West High School. She married Paul L. Smith in 1970. They later divorced. She then married Roger Downs, June 4, 1982. He passed away in 1995, and married Jerry Lafferty in June of 2015. She worked at GMAC in mortgage servicing, retiring in 1998. Dean loved Hawkeye football, cooking, gardening, canning, fishing, and spending time with her family. They spent a lot of time at Falling Rock Walleye Club in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, over the years. A private family burial will take place at a later date in the Memorial Park Cemetery in Waterloo. Memorials may be directed to the family. Locke at Tower Park is in charge of arrangements. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralservices.com. Next, Independence. George B. Aldrich, 88, of Brandon, Iowa, died Monday, September 5, 2022, at University Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City, Iowa. George was born on August 23, 1934, in Tama, Iowa, the son of Bernard and Bernadette Powell Aldrich. He was a 1952 graduate of the Brandon High School in Brandon, Iowa. He enlisted in the United States Air Force, serving until his discharge in 1957. Following his discharge, he entered Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, and graduated with an engineering degree. George farmed for 58 years in the Brandon area, as well as worked with White, Westinghouse, Wilson Foods, and as an electrician. He also taught journeyman at Local 288 in Waterloo, Iowa. George was a supporter of the Iowa Lions Eye Bank, and as such, donated his eyes to the Eye Bank for cornea transplant and research. He also served on the Buchanan County Conservation Board for over 20 years. On April 21, 1954, he married Beverly J. Williams in St. John's Catholic Church in Independence, Iowa. Beverly preceded him in death in 2013. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday at St. John's Catholic Church, with the Reverend David Beckman presiding, and he's assisted by Reverend Mr. Timothy Post. Burial will be at 1:30 p.m. Friday at the Brandon Cemetery, Brandon, Iowa. Friends may call from 4 to 8 o'clock p.m. Thursday at the Rife Family Center in Independence, Iowa, where a rosary will be recited at 4 o'clock p.m. and a parish vigil service will be held at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the St. Jude Children's Hospital, 501 St. Jude Place, Memphis, Tennessee. To leave an online condolence, please go to www.rifefamilycenter.com under obituaries. Jessup, Mark Allen Martin, 55 years old, of Jessup, Iowa, died Saturday, September 3, 2022, at his father's home in rural Jessup at Littleton. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, September 8, 2022, at White Funeral Home in Jessup, Iowa. Visitation will be Wednesday, September 7, from 4 o'clock p.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. at the funeral home, and also for an hour before services on Thursday. Interment will be at a later date in the Littleton Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be posted at www.white-mounthome.com. Mark was born October 27, 1966, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Niall Ronald McMartin and Sharon Lorraine Fifield McMartin. He graduated from Jessup High School with the class of 1985. In June of 1995, he and Christine Heather McAtee were married in Jessup. They later divorced. Mark worked as a welder. He was currently employed at Greeter Manufacturing in Independence, Iowa. Mark was a fisherman at heart and could make any fish fry a feast. He excelled in high school sports and enjoyed following football. White Funeral Home in Jessup, Iowa, is in charge of the arrangements. Maxine J. Anton, 97, of Friendship Village and formerly of LaPorte City, died Saturday, August 27, 2022, at Wellspring Living of Friendship Village. She was born June 25, 1925, in Waterloo, the daughter of Ray and Helen Plummer Thomas. Maxine graduated from LaPorte City High School in 1943. She continued her education at Gates Business College. She married Donald Alt Anton on September 3, 1946, in LaPorte City. He preceded her in death on April 18, 2008. Maxine worked as a secretary at Young Plumbing and Heating for 40 years. She was also the bookkeeper for Don at their business, Anton Sales. She was a member of St. Paul United Methodist Church in LaPorte City. Maxine excelled at playing bridge, having 70 years of experience. Maxine was an excellent cook and would often do a lot of canning at home. She loved people and could always strike up a conversation with a stranger. Traveling was another one of her passions, especially to Corpus Christi to visit her brother. Maxine's family would like to thank the amazing staff at Friendship Village who cared for her over the years. She made many special friends during her time at Friendship Village. There will be a public visitation at 12:30 to 2 o'clock p.m. on Friday, September 9th, 2022, at Locke in LaPorte City. There will be a private family service following the visitation. Burial will be Westview Cemetery, and memorials can be sent to Cedar Valley Hospice. Locke in LaPorte City can be located at www.lockfuneralservices.com. Donald Duane Eckerman, 88, born June 4, 1934 in Cedar Falls, died Friday, September 2, 2022, at his home in Waterloo. John joined the Navy in October 1952, serving on two aircraft carriers during the Korea conflict. His final tour was on the USS Kearsage as a Yeoman Class A, discharged from active service in July of 1956 and from reserve duty in July of 1960. Don was a longtime member of St. Paul's Presbyterian Church of Washburn, where he served as elder for over two decades, clerk of sessions, and member of the choir. He was a supervisor at John Deere Tractor Works, a member of AMVETS Post No. 49, where he served as post commander from 1981 to 1982, and as 3rd District Commander from 1983 to 1984. He also volunteered his time serving meals for NEIA Agency on Aging. On September 6, 1975, he married Barbara Chambers, and their combined families consisted of 6 children, 7 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren, and many nephews and nieces. Don's funeral service will be held at 9 o'clock a.m. on Thursday, September 8, 2022, at St. Paul's Presbyterian Church of Washburn, with visitation the afternoon prior from 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock p.m. at Dahl Van Hoof Schoof Funeral Home of Cedar Falls. Burial will follow at Hillcrest Cemetery of Dyke, with military honors by AMVETS Post 49 of Cedar Falls. Memorials may be directed to Cedar Valley Hospice or the Wounded Warrior Project, and condolences may be left at www.dahlfuneralhome.com. Cedar Falls. Gene F. Kelly, 98, of Cedar Falls, Iowa, passed away on the morning of Saturday, September 3, 2022, at New Aldea Lifescapes Nursing Home in Cedar Falls, while under the care of Cedar Valley Hospice. Gene Francis Wanamaker was born on July 2, 1924, in Waterloo, Iowa, the daughter of John and Louise Wanamaker. She was raised and educated in the Waterloo Schools District and graduated from West High School with the class of 1942. On June 23, 1953, Jean was united in marriage to the love of her life, Donald "Don" Kelly, in Camden, Missouri. The couple was blessed with a big family and all of the memories that came with it. Jean was not only a dedicated wife and mother, but an extremely hardworking woman. She dedicated well over 30 years of her professional career as the executive secretary at John Deere. And after she retired from John Deere, Jean went on to obtain the Lifetime Achievement Award and become the president of the highly respected organization, Brain Injury Association of Iowa. She was also a longtime member of the Red Hat Society at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Cedar Falls. Funeral services for Jean will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, September 8, 2022, at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Cedar Falls, located at 2410 Melrose Drive in Cedar Falls, Iowa, 50613, with burial in Memorial Park Cemetery, Waterloo. Public visitation will be from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. on Wednesday, September 7th, at Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway. There will be 1 hour visitation prior to the service at the church. The Reverend Elizabeth Popplewell will be officiating the service. Online condolences may be left at www.haggertywyckoffgrarup.com. That was the last obituary in today's Courier. Now we turn to the opinion section. This first editorial comes to us from the Storm Lake Times Pilot, and its title is, "We All Don't Benefit Equally from Government Aid." And the opinion piece was written by Randy Evans, and his byline is called Stray Thoughts. President Joe Biden's decision to cancel up to $10,000 in federal student loans for many borrowers is fair game for vigorous debate and disagreement. Americans have been debating and disagreeing for 246 years. What jumps out in this latest dispute is how some politicians are blind to the inconsistencies in their arguments against the economic shot in the arm when, through the years, they have supported other government incentives to various groups. To hear the comments of Iowans in Washington, you might think they have long been strong advocates for government butting out of personal finance decisions Americans make. But you would be wrong. Representative Ashley Hinson of Marion said waiving repayment of $10,000 of federal student loans would be a, quote, hand out to the wealthy and a total slap in the face of people who did not go to college or who already repaid their loans. Senator Joni Ernst of Red Oak asked why Iowans who go straight from high school into the workforce or pay for their own education should foot the bill for other people having $10,000 of their student loans forgiven. She said Biden is, quote, passing the buck to hardworking Americans, unquote. One flaw in such thinking is that the beneficiaries will be ordinary Iowans who are neither wealthy nor elites. They will be nurses, teachers, bookkeepers, cops, farmers, and store managers who graduated from Iowa colleges and universities and then went out and found jobs. In some cases, jobs employers have struggled to fill. Yes, these graduates will personally benefit from a smaller debt. The typical Iowa college loan borrower owns about $30,000, but the rest of us without college debt will benefit too. The money borrowers would have used for interest and principal on their loans will be used instead to buy goods and services at retailers and restaurants, all things that will create more jobs and more demand for the products and services that keep Iowa's economy ticking. The Biden directive applies to student borrowers who earn less than $125,000 per year, or couples whose annual income is not more than $250,000. Students from low-income families would be eligible to have an additional $10,000 forgiven. Those six-figure income ceilings have been criticized, and rightfully so, as too high, especially when the average household income in Iowa is about $60,000. Quote, it's bad policy as well as bad politics, National Democratic strategist Paul Begala said on CNN. Here's the inescapable reality about the reaction. Republican critics who think debt cancellation or six-figure income ceilings are unfair have voiced nary a peep of opposition in the past when there are proposals that benefit certain groups but not others. Like it or not, government has long favored some of us with special programs and policies, while the rest of us have to fend for ourselves. In the last half of the 1800s, the government encouraged settlers to move west by giving them up to 160 acres if they lived on the land and farmed it, even though millions of other people wanted land but were left out of the dirt-cheap deal. During the Great Depression, about 3 million unemployed men were hired to work in the Civilian Conservation Corps, although there were not nearly enough jobs to satisfy the demand. More recently, two federal government programs have been immensely popular with large groups of Iowans. The Federal Farm Assistance Programs and the $800 billion Paycheck Protection Program. The government-backed PPP loans went to many employers who agreed to keep employees on the payroll in the early months of the COVID outbreak and used the loan proceeds for business expenses. The loans did not have to be repaid if businesses used the money as promised. Of course, countless small businesses were left out of the Paycheck Protection Program, but those owners' taxes were used to help cover the cost of the loans that far bigger and much wealthier businesses did not have to repay. Forgiving the PPP loans was carried out in the current student loan forgiveness terminology on the backs of hard-working small business owners. The federal government's farm programs have been a lucrative source of revenue for farmers for the past quarter century. Look at the federal crop insurance program. Hard-working taxpayers with no ag holdings are having their taxes pay for nearly half of the premiums, with farmers taking care of the other half. The cost of this crop insurance subsidy is not pocket change. The Congressional Budget Office says it will be a $9.5 billion bill this year. Supporters are quick to remind us crop insurance is important to everyone because we are talking about food. Most of the insurance covers just three crops, corn, soybeans, and wheat. Most of the fruits and vegetables we eat are not covered by the federal insurance. But crop insurance is far broader than buying just-in-case protection against an unexpected weather calamity. 70% of the crop insurance policies taxpayers subsidize actually provides guaranteed revenue from each acre covered by the policy. If market prices at harvest time are below that target, the policy makes up the difference. If market prices at harvest time are higher than the target, the farmer gets the higher price. No other merchant in Iowa has the luxury of having the taxpayers cover half the cost of guaranteed revenue policy like crop insurance. A guarantee that effectively transfers the risk of crop prices onto the backs of working Americans. KCAU-TV in Sioux City had a report last week that Senator Chuck Grassley's family has received $1.75 million in government farm assistance payments since 1995. People concerned about college grads having $10,000 in college loans forgiven might be interested to know the Grassley farm payments come out to about $67,000 each year. Our next editorial was written by Art Cullen of the Storm Lake Times-Pilot. It's titled, Take What You Can Get for the Sake of Sanity. Crazy one way like the other, it's been a manic, depressive roller coaster of volatility the past few years. Laid low by a pandemic and watching democracy under direct attack on TV, you pray that people can come together. The West is on fire, for Pete's sake, and rise out of it. So they did, or so I thought, when the voters overwhelmingly threw out that loser Donald Trump and put in Joe Biden. He talked up a new social compact, an updated New Deal, irresistible to my naive hope that humankind is capable of saving itself. Congress came together to pass the Payroll Protection Program. It saved our newspaper and so many other small businesses. Unemployment coverage was temporarily enhanced, along with family assistance. It looked like we were actually restitching the social safety net. Congress passed a huge infrastructure bill on a bipartisan basis to fix our failing bridges and water systems. Then everything came to a halt. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, put a hand up against the train. Too much government spending will lead to inflation, he said. He swore off climate legislation. He urged more fossil fuel production. Congress would not make permanent benefits for families and those whipsawed by a gyrating labor market. Higher wages. Tyson has gone from $18 per hour for starters up to $21.50 in 2 years. Are eaten up by inflation in the three key areas of energy, food, and housing. Those drivers are all fueled directly by the pandemic, abnormally low interest rates for a decade, and open war in Europe. A more flexible unemployment system does not drive inflation, and neither does child care assistance. Climate change does drive food prices higher, as California decrops from persistent drought, and the Kansas farmers disc under this year's brown corn. The body politic thinks the nation has gone off track. You would like to dunk Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell in the Potomac, one with each hand, until they gasped for mercy. You ask yourself how Biden could squander this opportunity when the pandemic lays bare our faults so clearly, how he could not keep Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat from Arizona, in the fold. The spirit of Sam Rayburn, mentor of Lyndon Johnson, is withered in the congressional office building named for him. Coming in, Biden tabbed Tom Vilsack as his agriculture secretary. They said that this is it, the day that agriculture and the environment find common cause, something to be celebrated. But so little happened, you would not notice. The biggest deal to come down is a carbon pipeline serving corn ethanol plants in which Vilsack's son is involved. It made us believe that we would be left to the whims of nature and markets after all. To hell with a polluted river or the drought or whatever is roiling out there where you might not be able to grow corn in the next 10 years. Message from Washington, bend over and kiss yourself goodbye where the sun don't shine. 10-4, copy that? Midterms? What difference does it make? Over and out. Just when you're ready to swallow the poison, the investment banker and Senate Majority Leader from Wall Street get on the phone to Manchin and assure Manchin, a coal operator by trade, of a shale pipeline serving West Virginia, of the possibility of drilling more on public lands, and that a tougher IRS will crack down on tax cheats. Manchin drops his opposition to climate improvements as part of a $369 billion deal. Agriculture gets $20 billion. That is not nothing. The Conservation Stewardship Program is oversubscribed 3-1. Benefits are reduced or denied for conservation efforts on working land. This will help. The Environmental Quality Incentives Program works with the CSP and gets the biggest share of that $20 billion. It could be better. Trump, for example, showered soybean growers, processors, and traders with at least $60 billion in trade disaster payments over 3 years. But $20 billion can make a real start to dousing the fires and keeping the drought at bay. A day before the climate pact was announced, the Senate agreed to reshore the semiconductor industry from Asia back to the USA. No doubt West Virginia is prime territory for a new chip factory. You take what you can get. When Representative Liz Cheney, Republican, daughter of the former vice president with a permanent snarl, calls out Donald Trump as a complete fraud, you think that this is a pretty good day for democracy. When Joe Manchin becomes a climate action hero, you think that maybe we don't have to be fuel for the pyre. You believe that we can lead ourselves out of this mess, maintain the world's longest-running democracy, and possibly not asphyxiate ourselves, at least for today. Now we turn back to some local news from the Courier. Waterloo man arrested in Charles City shooting. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Charles City. A Waterloo man has been arrested in connection with a June 2020 shooting in Charles City. Floyd County Sheriff's deputies arrested Calvin Tillman Edwards, age of 20, on Friday in Waterloo, on a warrant for one count of intimidation with a weapon. Court records allege Edwards ordered another person to threaten three people and then shoot at a vehicle parked near them in the 600 block of North Iowa Street around 10:50 a.m. June 13, 2020. No injuries were reported in the shooting. Next, man arrested for using bad checks to buy cars. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man has been arrested for allegedly bouncing checks for two cars at a dealership in December. Authorities allege Devonta Cortez Parker Johnson, 20, wrote a check to John Deere dealership in Cedar Falls when he bought a $21,000 Nissan Titan pickup truck on December 11th. He also gave the business another check for an acquaintance who was buying a $11,900 Cadillac SRX on the same day. Next, Panther wrestler arrested for assault, filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Cedar Falls. a University of Northern Iowa wrestler, has been arrested following an argument with his girlfriend and two others last week. Cedar Falls police arrested Christian Basil Minto, 22, on September 1st, on one count of domestic assault causing injury and two counts of assault causing bodily injury, all misdemeanors. He was released pending trial. Authorities allege Minto had been involved in an argument over a cell phone at a West 27th Street apartment on September 1st. The girlfriend took the phone and ran out of the building, and Minto allegedly chased and pushed her to the ground, according to court records. Other people became involved, and Minto allegedly threw another woman who tried to break up the altercation to the ground and tackled a man and began fighting him, according to court records. Minto, originally from Cape Coral, Florida, had wrestled at North Iowa Area Community College and is currently on the roster for the UNI Panthers wrestling team for 2022-23. And now, listeners, that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, September 7th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.